This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. Today we present an imbizo on South Africa held recently at the Brecht Forum. The event was convened by youth, dignitaries, and diaspora of South Africa to address the current events, issues, and future of South Africa.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming this evening. We're very happy that you are here with us at this inaugural Imbizo event. Why Imbizo? Well, Imbizo, as you may already know, means a gathering. A bunch of us African kids around here decided to put this thing together because we feel that there's a need for us to get together and have these discourses. Our voices are missing all over the world. I mean, especially in Africa. The political discourse, you never hear about what the African youth want, what the Africans who are abroad want to do. We would like to be involved. And so this is our way of getting together with each other and friends of Africa, people who are interested, and sharing ideas and hopefully getting some really good feedback from the people out there to guide us along this journey that we've decided that we want to take. So this is going to be one of many Imbizos that we will be having, and I hope you'll be here with us through all of them. We're going to start with a discussion here with our friends. But before we get to these guys, we are going to treat you to a beautiful songstress, Tuelo Mina, our rising star. She's going to start this off with a beautiful song for us.
I'm going to sing a typically South African Dwana gospel song. Just to open up, really.
Thank you, Tuelo, for that wonderful piece. Next, we're going to introduce you to our moderator for the forum today, Robert Knight.
Thank you. I could not be more honored than I am today to be among my heroes of liberation. My name is Robert Knight. I'm the senior national correspondent at Pacifica radio station WBAI, where I produce a show called 5 O'Clock Shadow and another one called Earthwatch. And I bring greetings from all of the staff and management, listeners, and supporters of BAI, because our rejuvenated station, in following South African liberation, will get there with you. WBAI, we are the 99.5. And in the same way that South Africa has inspired me, the South African liberation movement has inspired the Occupy movement for the 99%. Because what is it about but majority rule? South Africa has, in a global leadership role, reversed the tyranny, killing, destruction, and dispossession of spirit of one of the most insane race regimes to ever visit this planet. South Africa, to me, is like a precious flower that in its growth requires tending. It sometimes needs pruning, and it must be constantly refreshed with the waters of freedom, finance, equity, opportunity, justice, and liberation. And that is why we are here tonight for this Imbizo, which is a festive gathering of policy analysis in order to continue the growth of the beautiful nation and people of South Africa. I'm sitting here next to heroes of mine. Sedizo Tipanyane, the former chief executive officer of the South African Human Rights Commission. Nomsa Mazwai, a tremendous talent of word and music. And oh yes, she's a Fulbright scholar at Fordham University, but she brought that from her education in South Africa. And Clement Fana Halangwane of the Pan-African Congress, one of the leaders of the Soweto Uprising. Take a few minutes to introduce yourselves.
Yes, my name is Sidiso Tikonyane. I'm a South African. I was born in a small town called Witsishoek in Free State, but I grew up in Pietermaritzburg, where my parents still live. But I studied in Lesotho, and I joined the ANC underground when I was 18 years in Pietermaritzburg. Then I came home as soon as Mandela got released to continue the human rights struggle in our country. And hence my last 13 years working in the South African Human Rights Commission, which has been established to promote and protect the human rights in South Africa. Thank you.
My name is Nomsa Mazwai, and I think it's best to say that I represent the future of South Africa. I was born in Soweto. I lived in Soweto my whole life until, of course, you know, freedom came and we started permeating, moving into the spaces that had previously been, you know, occupied. We really did occupy those spaces. We took the Occupy movement and we occupied the houses and the areas. So when my parents occupied, we moved out of Soweto. But I grew up in Johannesburg, and I went to a school in Johannesburg called St. Andrews, where I studied dance and matric. After St. Andrews, I went to UCT for one stint. We'll talk about that later. Then I went to the University of Fort Hare, and I think that's where I became, a critical thinker, because I, for the first time in my life, I suppose, I was exposed to what people know what the real South Africa is about. I think when you live in Johannesburg, you don't really see the whole picture. And so when I went to the University of Fort Hare, I really got to see this first and second economy that Thabo Mbeki was talking about. And I realized that there is a role that every single young South African has to play. So I started being an activist in education then. I've worked for the Nelson Mandela Institute in education. I've worked in rural schools. That's where my passion is, in education. And then I applied for a Fulbright scholarship. I'm doing my master's in economics at Fordham University. And my work is really about, you know, how do we make economics work in, because economics is supposed to work in different settings. It's not supposed to be one thing. So it's for me just to come and see and to research a little bit more and to know exactly what not to do when I go back home. But yeah, so I've been here in New York for a little over a year, and I'm finishing my degree in December, and that's me.
My name is Fana Clement Khangwane, born in South Africa, in Soweto, and raised partially in Soweto. I went to school in Skanundwana High School, eventually went to Maurice Isaacson, which is projected in the movie Sarafina. And what you see in Sarafina is what I was part of. I feel honored to be among the few heroes that are with me here. I guess I'm the oldest of the two people. And I'm also honored to be next to the future of South Africa. I never got to a stage whereby I say I'm joining politics. It was part of my life. I had no choice. And growing in Soweto, politics was my everyday thing. And I had a situation problem that is a little different from probably other people. I was deeply involved in politics, and my father was the South African police. When I come home, I had to wear a different cap. Never talked to my father about politics. When I'm out there, he only heard about all the activities that I was involved in. In fact, he was shocked to find out that I was indicted in absentia in the Bethel 18 case of 1978, where a lot of people died in Robben Island. I was fortunate that I sneaked out and I left. That's how I was indicted in Bethel 18 case with great guys like Robert Sobukwe and the rest of them. I think I'm fortunate that today I'm still here and I'm sharing this with you, but I feel humbled to be called a hero. The only person who usually calls me a hero is my mom. This is like probably the second time that I'm called a hero, because even my friends, they call me, they say I'm smart, but when they get mad at me, they think I'm an idiot. But I'm going to share my experience with all of you. And thank you.
Well, the leading question is, after people of goodwill around the world invested energy, money, sweat, blood, time, and toil, and there came a transition that was called the liberation of South Africa, and what is presented as the dawn of majority rule. Do you think that has come to pass, and how fares the revolution, if indeed that is what it is to be called? How fares the transition in South Africa?
Okay. I guess I'll just be the youngest. I'll make all the mistakes and they can correct me. Well, I mean, personally, this is from a young person's perspective, because, I mean, when we got our freedom and we got our liberation, I was very young. And, you know, all I have to go on is what I read and what my parents tell me and what I've seen and what I've heard and what I see happening in South Africa today. And I had a lot of experience working in rural areas. So I think, and working in the second economy. So I think, personally, I think the way that South Africa transitioned into democracy, there were a lot of compromises that were made. I do feel that there were a lot of compromises that were made. And I can't judge the choices that were made back then, because I'm sure they were done. They were made at a particular point in time, and there must have been, you know, all sorts of kinds of pressures. You know, when you make a decision, it is based on, you know, how much weight, how much pull you have to make that decision. But I do think that, you know, there were a lot of compromises made, and I think those compromises have had an impact on the South Africa that we live in today. I think when people got the notion of freedom, there was this euphoria in the country, and everybody sort of got excited and really was hoping for, you know, big changes. But because of the kinds of agreements that were made in CODESA, you know, change wasn't going to be as rapid as people expected it to come. There was still going to be a monopolization of capital and of power in the country. And the problem is that this is just from my own, you know, I stand corrected. But, you know, I think when the country, in my opinion, when the country just made a decision to, you know, continue with, you know, neoliberal style policy without having mechanisms to redistribute or to make mechanisms for the release of capital from where it was, you know, where it was being held by one power. You know, I think that has really slowed down a lot of development in South Africa. And I think it's limited what the government can do and what the government has been able to do. So I do think that there is a democracy in South Africa in terms of a neoliberal perspective of what the West and what the rest of the world might think democracy is. But in terms of a meaningful democracy, I personally still think that we have a long way to go, and I think that there's a role for young people to play, and I think that we have to make a commitment as South Africans. I think what's the most important is that, you know, in 1994, you know, Nelson Mandela did say we are all South Africans. So I'm not going to have an opinion about who's an African, who isn't an African, who isn't a South African. But I think that there is a lot of responsibility, especially on my white counterparts in my country, my peers, you know, to also make a commitment to be South African and to also make a commitment to redistribution in the country. And I don't think that's happening. I think there's a lot of compromise on the part of the black majority to sort of accommodate. But there isn't the other commitment to make sure that there is some kind of redistribution, a sharing of the wealth of the country, a sharing of the pie.
Mr. Tipenyane.
Yeah, I have no fight with my sister here. I mean, as she said, she's the future, and she's giving her reflections on what she sees.
I mean, I just want to be a little bit uncharacteristic and say, you know, when I tell my son walking in the parks of New York that when I was young, I could not sit on a park, on a bench in the park, because it was called non-blacks. I remember one time in a small town in Vicksburg, actually I sat on a bench reserved for white people. I was not arrested. I was actually insulted by my fellow black people for being too big for my boots. When I tell my son that I could not go into a swimming pool in Pietermaritzburg because it was for whites only, he doesn't understand those things. Mm-hmm. When I came back in 1990 and I tried to buy a flat in my own town, Pietermaritzburg, I was told, sorry, we still have Group Areas Act, so you cannot buy a flat in town. And when you had to leave 10 Ks or more than 10 Ks from your office because of Group Areas Act, those were some of the things we felt. So from that perspective, for me, we have really achieved a tremendous things in South Africa from that perspective. I mean, I remember being in a train, seeing a white policeman kicking an old man, older than my grandfather, at his bum in front of his wife because he went into the wrong coach reserved for whites. And there was nothing he could do, and the humiliation he felt. Now, you know, we sometimes forget 17 years later that this is the reality or the experience for many South Africans. And this is what people fought against, you know, to be where they are today. But I do agree with it that, you know, unfortunately, when you look today at the economic realities, the fact that 70% of black South Africans do not own 70% of the wealth of the country, it's actually even less than that. Clearly, there are serious issues which have to be addressed. And to some extent, I mean, without blaming organizations too much, we have been shortchanged, largely because of international capital, which did not want to ensure that we actually achieve the ultimate goal of our revolution. Because, you know, as a member of the ANC, we believed in a two-stage theory. Of course, that will create other challenges. That, you know, we must first obtain a political emancipation, which we have obtained to a large extent, and then pursued with economic emancipation. Now, we are very far from that. Mm. And the sad thing is that, you know, just like under colonization, when some of our own people, you know, became agents of the oppressors, today we see our own people also, some of them, subverting our own struggle for economic emancipation. And therefore, there's a long way to go. And that's why my sister here represents the future, because that's the future we have to address as South Africans. And we fail, we'll be failing our people and the rest of the continent, not just South Africa.
Mr. Longone.
Basically, I'm going to follow the footsteps of the two great speakers. My father was a policeman. He was respected in the neighborhood. He was respected in church. He was a deacon. But a couple of times I went to his job, I saw my father for the first time become a small boy in front of little white boys. I saw my father for the first time acting like an idiot so that I can get food and shelter for myself. He was a very respectable man, but when I saw that, I never forget that. And I'm one of those people who's very critical. When I was in exile, I was in my 20s. I was in exile in Swaziland, I was in Tanzania, and all other places before I came here. We had our own perception of the freedom that we want in South Africa. At one time, there was a lull. We didn't know whether we're going or we're coming or going. Things went on, and I remember my first visit in 1992. I had this picture of mine of the type of freedom that I had in my mind. They say sometimes theory and practice are two different things. Yes, it's true. I didn't find anything closer to that. And I would be very unrealistic to expect that freedom or changes would happen overnight. When I listen to the two speakers, I also wish there was somebody from the government who can give us another perspective, because I feel the same way they feel. I don't feel like a few representatives of the government. They say every time I go visit South Africa, they always emphasize that, no, you don't understand climate. You don't understand. I don't know what is it that I need to understand. I strongly believe that we can do better than what we are doing now. I support the government of South Africa, I'm very critical of what they don't do good. But when they do good, I will support them too. The first phase when Mandela became the president was a great phase. Everybody, it was a euphoric phase, everybody. Mandela was more like a messiah. We needed somebody like Mandela. I'm this type of a person. I don't even carry a flag. I hate flags because flags, to me, reflect something that I hate. Because people who benefit from the flag are not the regular people. I will never see a flag in my house. You'll never see a flag in my car. Not because I hate the flag itself, the symbolism. It's because as little people, we carry the flag. But the people who benefit from all this don't carry the flag. They don't care about the flag. When I go back home all the time, I get very depressed that everybody that I know in my neighborhood, everybody that I know, it's like it's from economically from bad to worse. And some of us who are fortunate, when we go back home, we're able to mingle with the people who are comfortable. And when you use those people, we can think that the whole country is comfortable. Mm-hmm. We have a long way to go. I believe that the government can do better. We can do better. And I'm not a sentimental person. I would love my compromises because I've been here. I'm scared to say that I've been here probably for like 30-something years. I thought I was passing by. I thought I was on transit. I realized that after 32 years, I'm still here. When I came here, I was how old? Probably 25 years old. When I go back home in South Africa, I feel people, at one time, people were feeling good about themselves, especially during Mandela's era. But the more I go back to South Africa, I think the spirit is damp.
Thank you.
The spirit is damp. The mentality of the white folks is still the same. They still look down upon my folks. My folks are still not doing well. I don't want to monopolize this. I just step down for now. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, let's get radical. If South Africa is a beautiful flower, do you think that the liberation or the revolution or the transition or transformation has actually descended beyond the surface beauty to the economic roots of injustice and the continuity of the structures of the apartheid regime? And does an economic racism continue to exist? And if so, what is its effect on the 99% of South Africa?
Let me start by saying, you know, the official poverty rates, I think last year, you might correct me, from the Trevor Manuel's commission, was that, was it 40%?
I think so.
Around 40%.
Yeah.
Now that's a huge figure, 40% of the country, of about 50 million living in poverty below 500 rands a month. Okay? But now when you unpack that 40%, you then realize that almost 70% of African South Africans who make 70% of the country live in poverty. Now, in around 1999, the Human Rights Commission organized what we call poverty hearings. So we went all over the country hearing stories from poor people about their experiences. And then we had the same hearings in 2009, 10 years later. I was in Bloemfontein, and I was shocked when an old woman, a very Christian old woman, said, you know, to Archbishop Ndungan, that I'm very sad to say this, but actually for us, we're better off under apartheid. I mean, I was really, ideologically, I would have been very annoyed. But to hear it from an old lady who has got no political agenda, just telling about her own experiences. This week, I was talking to an old pensioner in South Africa over the phone, and you were saying, every year, like my brother was saying, it gets worse. Then he repeats the same statement, that, you know, it was better for us economically under apartheid. Now, there's someone quite close to me, and let me say my father for that matter. Then I said, damn, what does this mean? And the sad part is that, yes, as far as emancipation from poverty is concerned, we're not doing well. Government does provide social grants to about 15 million South Africans, and it makes news about that. But those grants are just 1,000 rands divided by 7 into dollars a month. And therefore, our people, to be honest, when it comes to economic issues, are really not that much better off. It might even be worse under apartheid. The only thing they live on is hope that there is a new government. Maybe things will get better. But 17 years later, really is not good.
I think for me, and this is an opinion that I hold, but I think for me the biggest problem was, you know, when you read Mandela's speech from when he came out of prison, and you compare it to the speech that he made when he got into power, I mean, you can see that there's just a clear shift from the left to the right. It's like from, we're going to make sure that wealth is redistributed to, we're going to make sure that South Africa is going to be a great destination for investment. I mean, really, that was a shift, you know? And I think the problem, and this is a global problem, the problem, I think, internationally is that we equate democracy with neoliberalism or with capitalism, and that's a problem that, you know, a country is not seen as democratic unless they follow this particular regimen. And unfortunately, you know, that kind of policy does not redistribute wealth. I mean, any country that you look at, if you look at Brazil, if you look at India, you look at South Africa, it only increases inequality. That's all that happens. So that's the only outcome that you can have. So it's not that, you know, the South African government is worse than the apartheid government. You know, it's just that they followed this policy and they followed it without sanctions. You know, at least during apartheid, the race to the bottom was not as fast because, you know, the international community had to some level sanctions against South Africa, so they couldn't run away with themselves and capital, really, you know. But if they had been given the opportunity, they would have, and it would have been we would be talking about the same problem. So I think, in my opinion, this obsession that the world has with equating democracy with your neoliberal style policy and ensuring that your markets are open for, you know, capital, and, you know, so that capital, you just basically make yourself a garden for capitalists. I think that's one of the biggest problems, and I think that is why there is an increasing, that's why the inequality and economic growth will never reach the people in those communities unless we start to restructure or rethink the way that we do things. But the problem now, if you as South African government and you want to embark on policy that is going to address those challenges that you have on the grassroots level, the challenge first in South Africa you face is that capital in South Africa is in any event is monopolized around the white elite and a black middle class. It's just that's the way it is. There's a few black people and the white elite that still manage capital in South Africa. And even beyond that, if you go into the international sphere, if South Africa were to do anything that was in any way going to redistribute wealth, I mean, even if you look at the redistribution of land in the country, this whole willing buyer, willing seller thing, it doesn't work, you know? And if South Africa makes any steps to make sure that there's redistribution, the very first thing that will happen is that the international community or investors will speculate, and the value or the trustworthiness of investing in South Africa will drop immediately. You know, I mean, immediately you get downgraded. You know, you're not the best investment destination anymore. You know, so, I mean, there is some blame that can be attributed to the South African government. But I think that, you know, and this is for all governments in the periphery, in my opinion. All governments in the periphery face the same challenge. And if you look at Mugabe, and I mean, I'm not, you know, I don't condone what he did, you know, when he is killing Ndebele people. And, you know, there's things that I just don't like about that he did. But if you look at when Mugabe finally was just decided, you know what, we're going to take back Zimbabwe and give it to Zimbabweans. I mean, that's the only reason why the Zim dollar, you know, there was so much inflation, and now, you know, international capital made it so that Zimbabwe couldn't succeed. But now, and I think Zimbabwe is going to be an example for the rest of the African continent, things are picking up. Things are changing.
And I know that it does have a little bit to do with, you know, there's a change in leadership, but the fact is that there was nothing wrong with investing in Zimbabwe. It was just that there was everything wrong with Zimbabwe making decisions to redistribute wealth to the people of Zimbabwe. We're talking about a Lancaster agreement the agreements of it were never met, you know? And the people in Zimbabwe never benefited from their land. And in South Africa, if we make those kinds of decisions, we try to make redistribute the wealth. We've just seen now with, you know, at the idea of nationalization, Moody downgrades us as an investment destination. It's not like people have dropped out of school. There's no strikes. There's no drama. It's just because there's an idea of a debate, just an idea. Don't even think like that. The international community, you know, they discipline. The core disciplines the periphery, and then we get blamed for that when there's no development or there's no progress. And unfortunately, on the ground, and I'm going to be done right now. Unfortunately, on the grassroots level, you know, people don't see that. They don't see how the international community impacts their daily lives. And unfortunately, you know, it's just a cycle that perpetuates itself of people just being disgruntled by the system. But we all need to understand that it is bigger than even the South African government.
Thank you. Thank you. Clement?
Just listening to you, I know that we have a bright future in South Africa. I'm sitting here from time to time. I think when I go back home, I ask myself this question, that when Mandela was released, who really benefited from his release? Because I really don't believe that our people really benefited that much as expected. I think the people who really benefited are multi-corporations, because now South Africa is stable and they're able to maximize their profits at the back of our people. Mm-hmm.
In the interest of time, we'll speak another 8-ish minutes or so, because we want to take some questions from the audience as well. Hence, I'm going to combine two questions now. What is the prospect of, I know nationalizing is a controversial word, but an equitable distribution of resources among the people that leads to other things like education, opportunity, advancement, and so on. What is the state and prospect of resources of South Africa for the majority of South Africans? And in conjunction with that, what role is the United States playing to aid or to retard that process?
Start again in a controversial manner. I'll start with the latter first. I mean, as a South African, we knew that
the apartheid regime was actually sustained by American governments for Cold War agendas, and also for access to strategic minerals, as well as the gold standard. Because if you will recall, the moment the West realized that we're going to be free, gold was removed as a gold standard. And banks in UK and US actually began dumping gold in the stock market to cheapen the value of gold. And therefore, our economy suffered as a first thing. Secondly, we are told that when Mandela went to Davos and reminded the Davos colleagues of the provisions of the Freedom Charter, he was apparently told that, listen, if you want to go back home and find your country in ashes, keep on your talk about the Freedom Charter. And very surprisingly, for a long time, the Freedom Charter was almost a forgotten document in the country because of its very clear provisions that the wealth of the country shall be shared. The banks, the land, the mines, industries will be nationalized for the benefit of the people of South Africa. Of course, we might haggle about the name nationalization, but what we're very clear, South Africans, is that we are fighting for control of our country and its resources. And that still has to happen. So yes, I mean, as my sister has pointed out, the Moody rating agencies and other agencies are clearly behind to ensure that, you know, us as developing countries are not able to stand on our feet. Because otherwise, where will they get cheap raw materials from? Secondly, where will they dump their weapons? America is the biggest exporter of weapons, and much of those weapons go to developing countries to perpetuate wars in Somalia and Sudan and whatsoever. So there is a big agenda. The sad thing, unfortunately, is that many of our leaders get bought and get tempted with private jets, fancy hotel accommodations in New York, big cars, and they forget.
You know, personally, in my opinion, and I think, and I agree with Salisa that, you know, a lot of people get, it's easy, you know, when the core has its little agents in the periphery, and it's easy to, you know, pull select people out and, you know, give them things and make sure that they maintain the system that you want in a particular country and make sure that, you know, that it's easy for you to extract the resources that you need and to enter markets so that you can dump whatever you don't want there, you know. But I do think that, you know, at least in my opinion, and I think I represent a big chunk of the youth. You know, redistribution of the wealth in South Africa is an inevitable outcome, and you know, it can be peaceful or it can not be peaceful, but it's an inevitable outcome. And I think that you know, in the next few years, this is a time that's really going to judge us. You know, it's going to be a time when But as a country, we have to be ready to make, you know, sacrifices. I think one thing Mugabe did get wrong in Zimbabwe was that I don't think he prepared his people for what was going to happen. And I know that when we talk redistribution in South Africa, there will be changes. People will suffer. You know, there will be a dumping of the South African rand. There will be a fluctuating and a dropping and a whatever. But the fact of the matter is, once you've got more than 10-12% inflation, it doesn't matter. Your money's worthless. Whether it's 100% inflation or 10,000,000% inflation, once you reach a particular point. And we cannot make any decisions without that happening in terms of how the international community is treating us. In terms of America, you know, I was in South Africa a month ago with my class from Fordham University, and we're going to study emerging markets. I think that was one of the best classes I took at my university because, you know, it's a class of economists, and now we're going to take a course on emerging markets that's offered by Fordham University in South Africa. And it's only Fordham University teaching this course, but they teach it in South Africa. And we go and we meet people from, you know, different places in business and the Reserve Bank for an analysis of the country. But I'm a South African. I've been living and working in those spaces. So, of course, you know, when we go to these places, you know, they're meeting a very junior person at the Reserve Bank. They're meeting people that were probably in first year when I graduated, you know. And it's, you know, it's like, it's kind of like a joke. And then you get to the American Chamber of Business in South Africa, headed by a South African who is perpetuating this idea, this threat, this, she's a fear-mongering individual pushing this, you know, if we have this nationalization debate, then this will happen and South African stocks will drop. And I think that's very important to identify that, you know, the American government, in my opinion, when I've engaged them in South Africa, they make sure that they create the right environment so that when the papers report what they plan to report, because South African media is not owned by South Africans. So Rupert Murdoch decides somewhere that, no, now, you know, South Africa is going to go in this particular trajectory so that they can either buy long or sell short and make their millions. You know, so she was there preparing making this ground fertile. And I think that's unfortunate, but it's the way global capital works. And I think as Africans, we need to, and as countries in the periphery, we need to understand that global capitalism will never be to our benefit. It will never serve us. And I think the minute that we can make that decision and understand that I might benefit from it, I might, when I go back home, yes, I could move into a nice house, have a nice car, drive past people on the side of the street and act like I don't see them and that they don't exist. But that's a problem, and it means that there's a problem with me as a person, there's a problem with my humanity, you know? So I think So I think, I know that it's going to be a difficult one to fight. It's hard to convince people to not feed this machine that's killing them. But it's something that we have to do, and I think it's a lot to do. It's going to happen a lot in our education. So,
thank you, Clement.
Thank you. I'm looking at South Africa from outside because I've been out for too long, but I go visit and I also follow it online, the news, what's going on in South Africa. And I happen to have a lot of friends who are in government. When I talk to them, it's like I'm talking to people who come from another planet. And they have very wonderful statistics. When they tell you about the housing situation and everything, they count all the numbers, it sounds beautiful. But when I go back to South Africa and see it, literally see it, it's totally different. And what happened in Zimbabwe was very scary for South Africa. Very scary. I remember when Mugabe started doing the redistribution of land, the West pressurized South African president to talk to Mugabe. He could not be harsh on him because he knew that South Africans were yearning. They were looking for, right, were also looking for the same thing. Because basically, we're fighting for the land. We haven't found the land yet. And right now, when you go to South Africa, I know the young people know about it. There's a gentleman, Julius Malema. This gentleman knows something about it. After Mandela, people were just excited with the flag running up and down. I don't know where this Julius came from. He's the man who makes people to talk about issues that concerns everybody. He talks about nationalization. He talks about fraud and corruption. He talks about the real things that the people, what did we die for? He talks about the real issues, and the government is panicking. Because all the things that he talks about are things of concern that everybody wants to talk about, but some of them are scared to talk about. Because I can assure you, if Jacob Zuma, the president, would have spoken about the things that Julius speaks about, he would have been out of that, what call, presidency.
It would
have been a no-fly zone in South Africa. Thank you. We're going to take a couple of questions from the audience, and as we prepare for that, I think perhaps those with questions should come around here so we can mic it. My final question is one that is required of me as an investigative journalist. You wonder why I wear black today. In South Africa, on the 22nd of November, the parliament enacted an information bill that places severe penalties on whistleblowers and investigative journalists who reveal so-called state secrets. I began my career revealing CIA operations and most recently a New York City Police Department document for crowd control and tactics at the occupation and other mass protests. Should I go to jail for that? And should a South African journalist face the possibility of more jail time than Madiba spent on Robben Island?
I know this is a very sensitive topic. In principle, I agree with you. There should be a freedom of the media. But I've been in some of the newsrooms in South Africa, and they have six journalists in there, and that's as a result of capitalism and competition. Newsrooms in other countries are pretty thin, and they're controlled. The media is controlled by somebody else. I mean, when you read a story in a South African newspaper, you hear a story on the news or just in JFR, just mainstream media. A high percentage of it is just taken from Reuters and wherever, just because of the way the system works. So the problem in South Africa is that the media in South Africa is not owned by South Africans. If it was owned by South Africans, I would support it. The problem is that journalists, spies, go and they take information from the government and they use it to delegitimize our leadership. If you read the Mail and Guardian, when I read the Mail and Guardian, sometimes it just makes me sick because they say things, when the government does something right, they say, wow, can you believe the government finally got it right? The tone of the way that they write things. And that, for the public, when you read a newspaper, you're not thinking like that as a person in just taking in information. And you teach yourself to not believe in black leadership and not to believe in a black government because black governments don't get things right. That's how I felt. I mean, when I engage the media in South Africa, and when they pass this bill, I don't support it in principle, But practically speaking, in South Africa, it was the only way to go.
I mean, I would say we fought for access to information. And I do hear the points raised by my sister, but I'm battling to find out why is government being so insecure about this. Because what many of South Africans are demanding, including COSATU, which actually has threatened to take this bill to court if it's not amended, is to allow that provision which, you know, will allow journalists or anybody else to disseminate classified information if it's for the public good. Now, the argument we're saying is that if the information is used for any other reasons, then it means those journalists themselves will go to jail for 15 years. And therefore, we're saying that, you know, at the end of the day, this information belongs to the people of South Africa. We're not saying that our secrets or nuclear weapons must be disclosed, but, you know, in the last 17 years, one has seen a tendency of abuse of power, abuse of citizens' institutions, and corruption. And therefore, some of us are actually worried that government wants to hide behind these issues. This morning, our commissioner of police lost an appeal for conviction for corruption. He was in the pockets of the mafia, and he was the former head of our Foreign Affairs Department and our former ambassador in Geneva. So you can imagine, what has he been doing? And when a good friend of mine tried to prosecute him, he was actually told not to do so by Thabo Mbeki. He was later fired by the government, and he won his case. So, you know, with this background and also the experience in Africa where former liberation movements come into power and start abusing power, we need to make sure that we protect. And therefore, I think that the harm to government is far less than the harm this bill will cause to access to information. Because not only the media, which has to, you know, has this right.
Thank you. Clement?
Basically, I think the two speakers have more information than I do. But one thing that I can tell you, that when I read the newspapers before the independence and now, the media is very harsh on this government more than they were on the previous government, the white government. And also, we have an issue here that if the media is still owned by the same people, we'll always expect that. And as far as the journalists are concerned, in South Africa, I have had my own experience with some of my friends. If you expose something that the black government is doing, some people would say, well, who are you working for? Are you working for the people, or are you working for the enemy? Mm-hmm. So you find yourself in a dilemma whether you should expose some of the people, black people in government, or just stand by and let things go. So it's very difficult. When you don't own the media, forget it. Because the media is still owned by the same people, and the economy is still in the hands of the same people that we were fighting for. So, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
We
have fewer than 10 minutes before the next spectacular part of this imbezel. This program tonight will have a cinematic presentation. So here now, as best we can, from the audience.
I am from Jamaica, and my ancestors, who were taken from the motherland and distributed throughout the world to create untold wealth for the capitals of Europe and the United States. And today, after hundreds of years, we are still here catching hell today and talking about what is happening to us. And we believe, many of us believe, that the descendants of the slave master is going to be any kinder to us than their ancestors were. It's not going to happen. It never happened. And it ain't going to happen. And Mr. Garvey, the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey, says, leadership, when you take unto yourself the role of leadership, it means pain, it means blood, and it means death. And I am saying to you, young people, the ANC has become a decrepit whole bunch of rascals who is now getting ready to collect what they believe the people of South Africa owes them. And they have collaborated with the enemies. The PAC is who I support because they seem to be the most progressive. And I want to know, where is the PAC in all of this? Where is Winnie Mandela? And are you going to sit by and let this young man, Julius Malema, be marginalized just as if, just as how they did Winnie Mandela.
Thank you for your question.
Because all the wealth of South Africa must come back into the hands of all the people.
Well, the Pan-Africanist Congress, unfortunately, is a much smaller party, and I think that's just the way life has evolved and how politics has evolved in the country. But I think the Pan-Africanist Congress played a very important role. My father was part of the PAC, so that's how I was brought up, you know, in Pan-Africanist thought. But I think also what we have to remember, you know, I might be making the wrong choices. I'm not sure if I'm making the wrong choices, but I do believe that, you know, there's a struggle to be fought in my country, and I know that in fighting that struggle, we have to go about in a particular way. Now, when in 1994, my president, Nelson Mandela, he said we're all South Africans, black, white, yellow, pink, gold, all of us. And I said, this is my president, this is my leader, and I follow him. And I will bring people in my country who are not being South Africans, we're all South Africans. If you're not being a South African, if you're not recognizing the role you have to play, if you don't admit that if I am living a life of plenty in a country where people are living a life of nothing, I inevitably have a role to play, and I will lose some of my opulence to make sure that, you know, there's development in my country. So, I mean, I will call people out on that and make sure that we all must understand that in liberating our country, we are all going to lose a little bit. There isn't a group of people that are going to benefit or to keep on growing as capitalists. In terms of Julius Malema, you know, I mean, my opinion on Julius Malema, I don't like to talk about people politics, because people are very fallible people. People, when you talk about individuals, I don't think it's a good way to tackle something, because Julius, as an individual, there's things I like about him, there's things that I don't like about him. But in terms of the message that he's talking about, I think that it's very important that we start talking about these issues. And these are issues that are being brought to the fore by the ANC Youth League. And I know that in terms of the ANC does need to review its politics a little bit. But you must understand, the ANC is a very, very broad church, and it represents a lot of factions. I mean, there is a very left side to the ANC and a very neoliberal side. And I think as the young people of South Africa, we are really looking into redistribution. And I know that we all understand that we have a responsibility to ensure that all the people in the country are liberated.
Thank you. We have time for one more audience question.
I guess I'm a young South African that have lived here for, I grew up here. What can we as young South Africans, there's a couple of us in the audience, what can we do? How can we help change the issues that are going on back home? How do we contribute?
I think what is really crucial is that all South Africans and Africans need to make sure that we do everything to make sure that South Africa succeeds. Mm-hmm. And I also want to say, I mean, we said this to government a few years ago, that if we don't address issues of poverty in South Africa, there will be another revolution in South Africa, mm-hmm. by poor people against all of us who are better off.
Personally, what I would say, because I've been involved here with so many organizations besides the PAC. Mm-hmm. I was PAC when we, before the independent, but right now more South African. And we had a lot of things that we did here. We had little organizations. For instance, in South Africa, we have the issue of HIV. We have orphanages in different parts, especially in the countryside. You find that kids from the age of probably 6 all the way to 13, kids are raising themselves. So we have those things, and we have organization in the neighborhood. Probably you can collect clothing, but there are so many ways that you can help. And also another thing, especially with the young people, it's education.
Final comments, either of you?
I mean, for me, really, I really believe that, I mean, the sad thing which happened is that, you know, after 94, many South Africans basically pulled back and expect the government and the ANC to do things. And it's our country, and I think we must take back our country and make sure that it succeeds. And I think South Africans should really get involved in all manner of things which will actually help to advance the country.
I'd like to thank our brilliant, ethical, and inspiring panelists tonight, Theliso Tipanyane, Nomsa Mazwai, and Clement Fana Halangwane. My name is Robert Knight, and on behalf of WBAI, thank you all for coming.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow, where you have been listening to an Imbizo for South Africa. Special thanks today to the Recht Forum, Grayson Challenger, Reggie Johnson, and Michael G. Haskins. We welcome your comments with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.